Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The fires burn on. 10% of Oregon's population is under evacuation order amid a rising death toll in the region as officials look to better weather for hope. Then, vote 2020. President Trump holds a rally with thousands of mostly maskless supporters before both candidates mark this September 11th. Plus, 19 years later, children born on September 11, 2001 are now eligible to vote in a country and world forever shaped by the events of that day. And it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks consider Congress' struggle to pass coronavirus relief, as well as the president's acknowledging he misled the public on the severity of COVID-19. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Fire crews in the West are finally getting help this evening from slowing winds and rising humidity. But a wave of wildfires has already claimed up to 24 lives across Oregon, Washington, and Northern California. In Oregon alone, 500,000 people have had to flee, and dozens are missing. Special correspondent Kat Wise reports from Salem, Oregon.
Early this morning, a team of firefighters gathered for a moment of silence in remembrance of 9/11. And then began discussing their plan of attack on the Beachy Creek Fire, which has burned more than 180,000 acres and destroyed a number of small towns. These firefighters, commanders, and support staff are one of the many incident management teams that assembled during wildfire season to battle blazes throughout the West. Late Monday night, as winds picked up across the region, a fire broke out around their incident command post in the small town of Gates, Oregon. As the fire quickly spread, the group, which totaled about 380, many of whom were staying in tents and campers outside the post, began a battle to save their own building.
As I walked out of the incident command post behind the building, the huge field that was behind it was completely engulfed in flame.
Randall Reisch is the public information officer for the team.
The wind was blowing, the fire embers were flying everywhere. Trees were coming down, electrified wires all over the place, roads are impassable, and have, you know, firefighters having to take chainsaws and buck those logs and get them out of the way so we could pass through. And everybody was able to work through that in a very dynamic and difficult situation without any recorded injuries. It's quite amazing.
Reisch and many others lost personal belongings. Some are still wearing the same clothes they had on Monday night. More significantly, the team lost critical gear and equipment.
Inside the incident command post, we have IT equipment, communication equipment, printers to make huge maps so we can have morning briefings. We have audiovisual equipment for the public information staff. All of the information that is associated with an incident are kept on thumb drives and hard drives, all of which were lost.
Despite all those losses, the team managed to reassemble by the next evening at this new command post in Salem. John Spencer is one of the group's leaders. This is his 36th year fighting fires.
The resources are thin, and so to get out on the line and have enough coverage, we don't. And so we are setting our priorities and meeting the fire where it forces our hand at certain communities and trying to engage so that we can protect life and property. Having your command center burn to the ground and having to evacuate that area under a very stressful situation was very, for many of us, has never happened before. And then the fire activity that we saw and how it's expanded to such a large scale over the whole state of Oregon and the Northwest, kind of shocking to all of us that have been around a while.
Across Oregon, about 1 million acres have been set ablaze and about 500,000 people have been ordered to evacuate, roughly 1 in 10 residents. The city of Portland declared a state of emergency as fires bore down on surrounding suburbs. Crews around the state have been navigating exceedingly difficult conditions. Unpredictable weather patterns change fire lines by the minute. State officials estimate they need twice as many firefighters on the ground as they have now.
Oh my God.
At the same time, there are fears some residents are not heeding evacuation orders, spurred in part by conspiracy theories and misinformation circulating online. Local police departments have had to squash rumors fires were caused by arsonists on both the far left and far right. Meanwhile, in California, the North Complex fire, which exploded in size earlier this week, has become the state's deadliest of the year. The fire has wreaked havoc in small towns across Butte County, which was also the site of California's deadliest fire ever, the 2018 Camp Fire, which claimed 85 lives.
There's a lot of folks up here that went through the Camp Fire and other fires that, you know, lost their place and or had to be evacuated for a month. They're really traumatized from this fire.
In Berry Creek, a small town of about 500, fires left behind little but rubble and twisted metal. And authorities fear the devastation in places like this means the death toll will likely go up. Back in Salem, the team here plan to take advantage of a change in weather today to finally make some progress on containing the Beachy Creek fire. They'll have six more days before their two-week shift is over. Then they'll be off for 2 days and back on the fire lines.
Forecasters say they are hoping for cooler air and moisture over the coming days, which would really help firefighters. Judy?
So, Kat, tell us a little more about the concern about fire crews right now, the worry about resources and people power.
Yes, that's right, Judy. Randall Reich, who you saw in the piece, he told us today that they're really trying to provide a lot of support to the firefighters on the lines and the team members who went through this difficult firefighting experience we highlighted in our story. But many of those team members have family and friends who are evacuated currently, and it's really taking a toll on them as they're fighting these fires. And of course, as you know, COVID is a big concern these days, and it is complicating all these firefighting efforts. Normally, at a fire camp like this, you'd have large teams working together in one room. At this command post, they have broken those teams up into smaller rooms to try to prevent the spread of COVID-19. But everyone is just trying to do the best they can during this really difficult time.
And as if things weren't difficult enough, Kat, you mentioned in your report authorities are trying to stop the spread of rumors about the cause of the fires. What are people telling you about that?
Judy, over the last couple of days, we've talked to several dozen people, and some people did tell us that they believe that the fires had been set by politically motivated people. One gentleman told me there's just no way that all of these fires could have been set by natural causes. But what's really important to note, Judy, is that over the last couple of days, national and local authorities have come out strongly and said that there is no basis for those claims. And they're really trying to get word out that people should trust only local officials, state officials, for information about these fires.
Well, to be dealing with that, as we said, on top of everything else, makes it so much more complicated. Kat Wise reporting for us from Oregon. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you, Judy.
This early fire season is historic and devastating in its scope and toll. As Kat reported earlier, fires have merged and are moving closer to the Portland suburbs. Portland itself at this moment has the worst air quality of any city in the world. The state's governor, Kate Brown, joins us now from Portland. Governor Brown, thank you very much for joining us. To people who've never experienced fires like this, give us a sense of what your state's dealing with.
Well, this has certainly been the perfect firestorm. We have unprecedented wind conditions combined with a 30-year drought on the landscape. And so we have seen devastating wildfires throughout the state. We've had 40,000 Oregonians that have needed to evacuate, 500,000 under some level of evacuation. And our firefighters are doing the best they can, but their primary focus right now is to save lives. And so that's where we're focused. That's where our time and energy is focused.
And right now we understand there are a number of people missing.
Yes. As I said, you know, our focus right now is on saving lives. These fires will need to be investigated over the next days and weeks. We are still obviously focused on evacuating people out of the most serious of circumstances, and we still have fires. Most of the fires are uncontained. We have never seen anything like this in the history of Oregon.
It's just unimaginable to so many of us. Governor, our reporter, Kat Wise, was telling us that there are that the state needs twice as many firefighters on the ground as you have now. Are you going to be able to get that much more support? Where is it going to come from?
That's a great question. We are very fortunate that we have 375 National Guardsmen and women who have been pre-trained to fight fire. Those units will be deploying today, tomorrow, and Sunday. We are going to be training, thanks to the help of our federal delegation, Senator Merkley and Senator Wyden, an additional 300 National Guardsmen and women. We have requested assistance from our federal partners. We're hoping for active duty military, trained battalions from the Department of Defense, trained in firefighting, and hoping that some other states will be able to provide additional National Guard resources. But as you know, this is a challenge facing the entire West Coast, and our firefighters are spread very, very thin. We're working hard to get them more people power and additional resources as quickly as possible.
And that's why I was asking if you think you're going to be able to get everything that you need. Governor, there are, as our reporter Kat Wise was telling us as well, these rumors or conspiracy theories going around about the cause of the fires, leading some people not to heed evacuation orders. How much of a problem is that? What's going on?
As the law enforcement community has said and reiterated in social media posts, these rumors are absolutely false. We need folks to stay off the 911 lines if they are concerned about these rumors. And we need folks in Oregon to be alert and paying attention to their local county emergency management website about what appropriate actions they can take. All of these fires will be investigated. I am confident that our law enforcement community, combined with our assistance from our Department of Forestry and our National Guard resources, that you will see thorough investigations of the causes of these fires. But as I said, these are historic and unprecedented. Given where we are on the West Coast, we are likely to see more of them with the impacts of climate change happening here in the Pacific Northwest.
And Governor, we see that the protests that have been ongoing in the city where you are in Portland for months now are continuing even through this state of emergency that's been declared. How much of a concern is that?
It's certainly a concern. I've worked with our community partners, our business community and elected leadership to craft a statement of Oregon leaders saying that this violence needs to come to an end. We are continuing to have conversations with folks in the community about how we can tackle the underlying racism issues that are really the underlying cause of this situation. And we are continuing to take action. The legislature has passed six bills in the last 2 months addressing police accountability. And I am working to recraft, re-envision how we train law enforcement in this state and how we can co-create a new type of public safety that will ensure that all of our community members feel safe.
So in a sentence, how confident are you that there will be an end to these protests in coming days?
Well, Judy, that's a really challenging question. Dr. King said it best, riots are the language of the unheard. So we know that these protests are caused by folks who have been experiencing systemic racism in this state and in this country for decades, for centuries. And it will take time, frankly, to eradicate the racism in our criminal justice system, in our law enforcement system, in our healthcare system, in our educational system. Violence does nothing. It answers nothing. It solves nothing. But I do think that it is a distraction from the critically important work that we need to do to tackle the systemic racism in our institutions, cultures, and state.
Governor Kate Brown of Oregon dealing with a lot right now, to put it mildly, with regard to the fires and, of course, with the ongoing unrest in Portland. Governor, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Be safe.
And you. In the day's other news, the nation marked 19 years since the September 11th attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people. Ceremonies unfolded against the backdrop of the presidential campaign. Both President Trump and Democrat Joe Biden visited Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Biden also appeared in New York. We'll have details after the news summary. Bahrain today became the fourth Arab country to normalize ties with Israel. President Trump announced it just weeks after the United Arab Emirates took the same step. In Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu went on national TV.
Citizens of Israel, this is a new era of peace. We have invested in peace for many years, and now peace will invest in us and will lead us to very large investments in the Israeli economy. And that is very important.
A senior Palestinian official called Bahrain's decision, quote, another stab in the back. Fire teams in Beirut, Lebanon, have put out a huge fire that broke out Thursday at the city's port. White smoke simmered over the site today, just a month after a disastrous explosion that killed 190 people and injured thousands. No one was hurt in this fire. The cause remains unknown. In Greece, migrants protested today after fires gutted a camp that was housing 12,000 people on the island of Lesbos. Thousands demanded that they be allowed to leave the area, but Greek officials refused. Instead, they sent tents and supplies for a new camp, and a European Commission official promised help.
We are dealing with the immediate needs, which concern accommodation and food, to guarantee that those who were left without shelter have what they need. At the same time, in cooperation with government and authorities, we are planning for the future, a new camp that will function with new standards and better facilities.
Greek officials say that the fires were deliberately set by some of the migrants. In pandemic news, the United States closed in on 193,000 deaths from COVID-19 today. Meanwhile, Florida moved to ease restrictions, with bars reopening Monday at 50% capacity. And last night, the National Football League season kicked off in Kansas City with a limited audience of 17,000 fans. The Super Bowl champion Chiefs beat the Houston Texans. Protesters in Minneapolis urged a judge today to try four former police officers together for the death of George Floyd. Defense attorneys argued for separate trials and also asked to move the trials elsewhere, something that the Floyd family opposes.
The only goal they have in trying to change venues is to get as many jurors as possible who do not look like George Floyd. They don't want jurors that look like you. No, they do not.
Dozens of people surrounded the courthouse protesting Floyd's death. He died last May when one of the officers pinned him by the neck. Relatives and victims of the 2017 Las Vegas shootings are closer to a sweeping settlement with MGM Resorts International. Newly filed court documents say that more than 4,400 relatives and victims could receive $800 million in payouts. MGM Resorts owns the hotel where the gunman opened fire, killing 58 people and injuring more than 850. A federal appeals court today barred felons in Florida from voting until they pay any outstanding fines and legal fees. The order was a victory for the Republican governor and legislature. It also could affect the presidential race in a state known for razor-thin voting margins. And Wall Street finished the week on a mixed note. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 131 points to finish at 27,665. The Nasdaq fell 66 points, and the S&P 500 added one. Still to come on the NewsHour, the race for the White House continues as the president and Joe Biden sharpen their critiques. Children born on 9/11 are now eligible to vote in a world forever shaped by the events of that day. Mark Shields and David Brooks examine Congress's struggle to pass coronavirus relief, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The presidential race struck a somber note today as both candidates marked the 19th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden visited the same Pennsylvania memorial, though they did not cross paths. White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor begins our coverage.
In Shanksville, Pennsylvania today, bells tolled for all 40 passengers and crew who died on Flight 93. On 9/11, those on the flight wrestled back control of the plane from hijackers targeting the U.S. Capitol. Instead, it crashed in a rural Pennsylvania field, killing everyone aboard. President Trump spoke at a memorial built on the crash site. He talked directly to family members of those killed.
Today, every heartbeat in America is wedded to yours. Your pain and anguish is the shared grief of our whole nation.
Later, former Vice President Joe Biden also paid his respects at the Flight 93 memorial. He laid a wreath and met with family members of those who died. The Democratic presidential nominee began his day in New York City. He attended the ceremony at Ground Zero of the World Trade Center. There, he stopped to talk to a woman who lost her son in the attacks. He spoke about the pain of losing his own son, Beau, to cancer.
It never goes away.
Vice President Pence was also at the Ground Zero remembrance. Both men wore masks and spoke briefly, acknowledging each other with an elbow bump. At the commemoration, Pence and his wife, Karen, read Bible passages.
Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me.
The vice presidential nominee for the Democrats, Senator Kamala Harris, spoke in Virginia at the Fairfax County Public Safety Headquarters. Her message was to first responders.
Some of the heroes from that day 19 years ago are still right here serving this community. And I thank you on behalf of all of us for the consistency of your dedication to your country.
Today's solemn tome came after a raucous night for the president in Freeland, Michigan, where he held a rally. Thousands of Trump supporters packed together in an airport hangar. There was little social distancing and few wore face masks. It came 2 days after audio conversations with the president, tied to a book released by journalist Bob Woodward, revealed President Trump knew about the severity of the pandemic early on, but he sought to play it down. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Alcindor.
And for more on all this, we have the NewsHour's Daniel Bush, who joins us today from Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Hi, Dan. So as we heard, both President Trump and former Vice President Biden were there today. What else can you tell us about what they had to say?
Well, Judy, President Trump delivered remarks that were on script. He did not stray from his message, praising the heroism of the people who died here at this site. Joe Biden did not deliver official remarks. He did visit this memorial and then with his wife, Jill Biden, visited a local firehouse. The most interesting thing to note here, Judy, is that, of course, this visit by both of these candidates, the backdrop is the election, and we saw two different approaches to being out in public during the pandemic. President Trump and the people around him did not wear masks. Joe Biden and his wife and the people he was meeting with did. Biden told donors on a call yesterday that he plans to abide by state restrictions, and that's what we saw here today.
Separately, you've been in Pennsylvania now for several days reporting on how they're preparing for this election, and in particular looking at how they're going to be voting and some disputes that have come up. Tell us about that.
That's right, Judy. Top of mind here, as in other states, is election security, how to get enough poll workers. There's a shortage there, many officials have told me, how to secure safe polling sites. But the main issue is a set of lawsuits that are going to dictate how people can actually vote in November. The principal one everyone is watching is a Trump campaign lawsuit, along with the RNC, filed against the state to try and ban drop boxes in November. These are the mailbox style drop boxes that many states have used for a while, that Pennsylvania used in the primary to allow voters to drop off their mail-in ballots in person to avoid long lines and to reduce public health risks. The Trump campaign is arguing that those drop boxes are illegal, they're not technically polling places, and that they could lead to voter tampering and fraud. But Judy, on the ground, county officials tell me something different. I spoke to several Republicans who said, no, these drop boxes are secure. One of them told me they are, in the primaries, were under 24-hour camera surveillance. Sheriff's deputies are there. This official told me that she herself manned one of the drop boxes, and they are not concerned about voter fraud. But that's a case that's playing out in the courts right now.
And Dan, you're saying even Republicans are saying this to you.
That's right, Judy. Several Republicans told me that they do not have concerns around voter fraud, but there are several challenges around how it is that people can vote, as I mentioned, carrying these off safely, as well as what is going to happen on election night. Several officials from both parties told me that unless they have more time to begin counting these votes, and if there is this expected increase or influx in absentee ballots and mail-in ballots, they will not be able to count the votes on election night. It's so important to all of them to underscore that point. They are saying they can expect to have to count some of these votes for days to come after November 3rd.
Daniel Bush, so interesting, and I know this is something we're going to want to follow very closely between now and the election. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Some 13,000 babies were born in the U.S. on September 11, 2001. Today, those babies turn 19 years old. And this fall, for the first time in their lives, they will be able to cast a vote in a presidential election. Amna Nawaz has more on the political views of voters born on one of America's darkest days.
Judy, those young Americans' lives have been shaped by wars, by school shootings, and now a deadly global pandemic. Garrett Graff recently interviewed several of them for his piece in Politico magazine. It's called The Children of 9/11 Are About to Vote. He's also the author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Only Plane in the Sky, an oral history of 9/11. Garrett, welcome back to the NewsHour. It's always good to talk to you. It is remarkable to read in your latest piece. These young adults have only ever known a nation at war. In fact, one of the young women, Chloe, said this to you. She said, every single day since I was born, we haven't been in a time where we're at peace, which is a remarkable thing to read. What did these young Americans tell you about how they view America's wars after 9/11?
Part of what is so fascinating, Amna, is that for them, it's just been background noise. I mean, they have, as you said, never known a day of peace in their lives. And so they have very little understanding of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, why we're there, and really have learned very little about the wars in school.
Another thing that struck me was, for so many people before them, 9/11, the day they were born, was the big moment. It was a defining moment. Of course, it wasn't that way for them. When you ask them about those big moments, though, many of them cited a shooting of some kind. One of them, Aiden, actually said this to you. In the back of my mind, I'd sit in class and I'd be like, all right, well, if something happens, how am I going to escape? What am I going to do? Am I going to hide? Am I going to jump out a window? This is from Aiden. I know so many young Americans feel the same way. It's become normalized. Was that sentiment true for most of them, Garrett?
Almost exclusively. Every single person that I talked to, for many of them, for many of this generation, the first national news event that they really remember is the massacre at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. And then they were high school students alongside the students of Marjorie Stoneman High School in Parkman when that was when there was a mass shooting there. And that for many of them, this is a backdrop to their daily educational experiences now. You know, police officers in schools, active shooter drills, This is something that they think about many days at school now, which is sort of unfathomable to those of us who grew up in previous generations.
As we mentioned, too, they are now about to vote. And in the background is this global pandemic. There's also nationwide racial justice protests unfolding. What did they tell you about how they're viewing both of those events and also how they're viewing this election?
Well, one of the things that just really struck me, I mean, again, this is a generation born on 9/11, grew up in war, experienced this mass shootings, graduating high school and starting college now amid this pandemic and these nationwide protests. And in many ways, they would have every reason to have given up believing in government and their country. And in fact, I actually saw just the opposite, which is there was a remarkable amount of hope and optimism about them that their generation will be able to change America for the better as they come into politics. I mean, one very big area for them is LGBTQ rights, that this is something that they have grown up with, widely accepted among their peers. Remember, for many of them, gay marriage has been legal for more than half of their lives in many states. And so this is something that is sort of background noise, again, in a very positive way socially for them.
One of those quotes actually that stuck out to me that speaks to that was from a young woman named Adsol. You asked about the chaos and the turmoil. She mentioned the previous generation saying, well, millennials are a lot more weary. They came into adulthood during the recession. They lived through 9/11. I think their view is a lot more depressing, she told you, whereas Gen Z, our generation, things can only get better. Is that generally the sense among these 9/11 babies, Garrett, that it can only get better from here?
That was actually my favorite quote in the entire piece, because it was the one that was most surprising to me. The idea that they would look ahead and see the millennials as the cynical, weary, tired ones, and that their generation they see as having nothing but hope and optimism about the future. I mean, I was expecting a much more depressing portrait of their view of America.
I have to ask you about one quote that really struck me, because it is their birthday today. It's also a day of national mourning. And there was one quote from someone named Lakin who said that, she was listening to radio stories about kids who'd lost their parents on 9/11 and realized, that's when I first realized I was born on the worst day, which is just a heartbreaking thing to read. When you talk to them, though, Garrett, really briefly, how do they view this day?
Again, very little memory of it. This is something that for many of them, their parents are talking about their birthday is the only real memory that they have. Lakin, actually, a remarkable example of this. Her name, she says, her mother has taught her, means a newly created gift from God, and that she was named that because she was born on 9/11, with the sense that sort of this was a moment of hope amid so much national tragedy.
It was very nice to see those messages of hope. We should say happy birthday to all of them from us. Thank you to them for sharing their stories. And Garrett Graff, thank you to you for bringing their stories to us. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And now it's time for the political analysis of Shields and Brooks. That is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. Hello to both of you on this Friday night. And so good to have just heard the conversation Amna had with Garrett Graff, telling us this younger generation turning 19 today have an optimistic view of the future. Isn't that something uplifting for all of us to hear? But Mark, back to reality right now, and that is, even though this pandemic marches on, and even though we've got millions of Americans unemployed, Congress, again this week, did not come to an agreement on relief, economic relief to those affected by the pandemic. How much does this matter? Who is responsible?
I think it obviously does matter a lot to the people, Judy. You know, it's a very unnerving and embarrassing national statistic. The United States alone of Western democracies has the highest percentage of children living in poverty. That has been the case. Children, you may have noticed, don't buy tickets to fundraising dinners. They don't have soft money, and they don't have much clout. politically. They are the victims, and they're anything but silent victims, but they're powerless victims. And they count upon Washington and those in the state capitals and city halls to represent their needs and to tend to their problems. And I quite honestly think it's a reflection badly on both, on the Congress itself. Politically, I think the ultimate responsibility, as it invariably always does, will be with the White House, and that's the president, and that's the Republicans. But I think, quite frankly, that there's enough restlessness and restlessness in the ranks of both parties of not doing anything, that there's still an outside chance that something could be done before the 30th of September.
By the Congress, you're saying. David, what about that? Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. You said by the Congress. But, David, what about this question of who is more responsible? The Democrats acted months ago. The Republicans have waited. They're now pointing fingers at each other.
Yeah, I thought they took turns. I think on the larger issue, the Republicans probably had this one wrong. They're treating this as a normal fiscal circumstance where it's important to save money and be fiscally responsible. And they point out that hundreds of billions of dollars of the last CARES package have not been spent yet. But the fact is, this is not a normal circumstances. Most economists, even Republican economists, say this is an extraordinary circumstance. At least 63 million Americans are in serious trouble. There's hunger in this country. This is a time to be spending money out the door just to provide a cushion under people in a circumstance they can't control. So I give the intellectual fault to the Republicans. I give the political fault to the Democrats from the beginning. They have played this more politically, compromised less, tried to get the issue more than solve the problem. And even in the final days, the Republicans proposed something like $500 billion in the Senate. The Democrats passed something for about $3 trillion in the House. If I were a Democrat, I'd say, hey, people are starving out there. They're only going to give us $500 billion. We'll pass that. We'll take it to conference. We'll try to get it up. But $500 billion is not what we want, but it's a lot of money and it could help some people. And then we'll have an election. We'll try to do more later. So I think even at the end of the day, they should have taken the money, because Americans are suffering. And so they took the issue instead of at least a piece of the solution.
I mean, Mark, I mean, for the ordinary person, it's just hard to understand why, when the need is so great, there's no action.
No, I agree. But I just want to correct the record. All the respect and affection I have for David, he's absolutely wrong on this. The Democrats' initial legislation, which they did pass, Republicans have passed nothing, was for $3 trillion. Then when the stalemate hit, the Democrats said, okay, we'll drop it down from 3 to 2. And what did the Republicans do? Their initial offer had been $1 trillion. So what did they do? Did they try and meet them halfway? No, they cut it in half, down to $630 billion. I mean, so it was strictly pro forma and quite counterfeit. And the reality is, they cannot talk about the national debt. The national debt has increased 40% since Donald Trump took the oath of office. And they're the best economy in the history of the country, according to Donald Trump. The national debt, the national deficit has been met only 3 times in the past 51 years. All 3 times with a Democratic president, Bill Clinton. Let's not let the Republicans talk about deficits and debts. When it comes to tax cuts, they're off the boards and they're off the books.
David?
Threw me a lot there. So a lot of the Republicans didn't want to do anything. They thought they'd spent $3 trillion and that was enough. And so when they came up, they were at that point where they were at $1 trillion of additional spending. I thought Democrats should have seized on that moment. And I think they, in the first round, this was months ago, the Democrats could have come down and really worked out something. But in the second round, then after that round fell apart, then the Republicans were like, okay, we're done here. And what they proposed was pro forma. On the deficits, in this moment, I completely agree with Mark. This is not a moment to be thinking about deficits. In the long term, I still think there's importance. When you pass 100% of debt to GDP, you're dancing with historically dangerous territory. That's a problem for another day.
Yep.
It's not the problem for today.
Such a tough issue. And I do want to turn, Mark, to the story that we've been discussing for the last few days, and that is the blockbuster book, another book by Bob Woodward, the journalist. Rage is the title. New revelations about President Trump, about what he knew about the pandemic, about COVID-19, and what he said publicly. What's your main takeaway from this?
My main takeaway, Judy, is that this is not a movie we've seen before. Whenever an unflattering attack book comes out about a president or a White House, they're immediately, the sources are dismissed as fired staffers, as people who weren't that close and never saw the president, who had a grudge of some sort. The source on this is the president himself, on tape, on the record. And, you know, all I could think of was that night in August when we all sat together and listened to Kristen Ozika, the young woman from Arizona, whose father, Mark, at age of 65, had died from COVID-19 because, as she put it, he believed the president. He returned to his normal activity. He was a very social animal. He loved people. He went out, took the chances, contracted COVID-19, and died alone, 5 days in a ventilator, all by himself. And as she pointed out, his only pre-existing condition was believing Donald Trump. That was his only pre-existing condition. And we live in two Americas, the one her father died in and the one Donald Trump lives in. And this to me is just, it is beyond shocking. This is a new territory for any president. And yet I will predict that in the next poll next week, he will still have the solid support of 41, 42, 43% of the people.
David, your main take, and how much do you think it will affect the public's view of the president?
Well, in ascending levels of disgust, first, the hubris to think you could be the president, talk to Bob Woodward and not get hurt by it. Donald Trump walked right into this. Two, the extreme cynicism, not only bumbling around in February and March because you didn't know how serious the pandemic was, but the confirmation that you did know and you still thought you could talk it down as if you can talk down a force of nature and that this you wouldn't end up getting caught. So there's just a level of cynicism that's been revealed, more than just incompetence. And then finally, and to me this is most revealing, I guess, is the idea that if you had told the American people the truth, they would have panicked. It betrays a disregard and a condescension toward the American people, which is totally ridiculous. And so I do think there's new stuff here, as there was last week in the Jeffrey Goldberg piece about what he said about the war dead. There's just a continued display of mischaracter, of poor character, immoral character. We've seen it before, but it seems to escalate from time to time. As for whether it will hurt, I guess I'm with Mark. 3 months ago, Joe Biden had a 7.5% lead in the poll, in the average of polls. A lot has happened in the last 3 months. Joe Biden has a 7.5% lead. And the thing I would like to emphasize is that a lot of voters have given up on politics. They're what we call low information voters. And the emphasis there is on low. They've written off politics. They're not paying attention to any of this. They'll probably never hear the Bob Woodward revelations. And so we have a race that is locked in stasis. But the bad thing for Donald Trump is he's only got a few weeks left, and this was yet another week of crisis and scandal that he was not catching up. So you don't have that too many weeks left, and this was a week that was, as far as his campaign is concerned, is wasted.
And very quickly, finally, to each of you, Joe Biden's message, is it coming through? Mark?
Judy, Joe Biden, I think, is coming through as a decent person. There's an old saw in politics, and that is for any candidate, tell us why you want to be governor or senator or president without mentioning your opponent once. I think that would be a very good discipline for the Biden campaign to go through. Joe Biden, America, understand this, is always in the market for one of two types, either a compassionate conservative, a conservative with a heart, or a liberal with a backbone, a tough liberal. And I think Joe Biden can show more toughness. There are no riots. There are no burnings or buildings that are acceptable. And Joe Biden's got to make that clear while he stands, as he has for his entire career, for justice racially and economically in the country. I mean, that's got to come across.
And David, just in a few seconds, the Biden message.
This is our week to disagree from Mark and I think he's been pretty tough. This week he called the Trump despicable. I think, you know, he hops on the weaknesses of the weak and he hammers them. And senior citizens are backing Biden and not Trump in reversal of 4 years ago, in part because of COVID and because Biden spent the week more or less hating him on that issue. I think it's a pretty solid issue.
We're going to leave it there. We thank you both, David Brooks, Mark Shields. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
As we remember the thousands of Americans who lost their lives on this day 19 years ago, we also remember those who passed away in the last weeks and months from COVID-19. Any friend who needed a home found one with Rhonda Felder. In her two-bedroom San Diego apartment, Rhonda raised her two children, as well as at least eight neighborhood children and cousins without a place to live.
I'm thankful for my children that I gave birth to and the ones I didn't give birth to.
She believed there was always more to give, her daughter said, and even went back to school at age 50 to become a social worker. Rhonda was 60 years old. Volodymyr Walter Lizniak came to America after World War II as a displaced person. Hoping to keep alive stories of his native Ukraine, he founded the New Theater in New York City. As an actor, theater director, and set designer, he put on countless plays. Some covered somber topics like the Ukrainian famine. Others were comedies. It was on stage that he met his wife, also an actor. Together, they raised their two great loves, their daughters. Walter was 92. Jimmy Sanchez was a natural salesman with a knack for fashion. Following in his parents' footsteps, Jimmy opened his own thrift store in San Antonio. He was known for gifting clothes and toys from the store to families in need. Witty, loud, and the life of the party, his wife said there was never a dull moment when he was around. He loved movies, traveling, and spending time with his four children. Jimmy was 40 years old. Linda Gail Wilson made a friend of everyone. Her son said she never met a stranger. A dedicated counselor, Linda worked with first-time offenders and the formerly incarcerated. She believed in second chances and that a little guidance could go a long way. Linda enjoyed spending time with her husband. A lover of literature, she enjoyed reading the Peter Rabbit books to her two sons and later took up writing poetry as a hobby. She passed away in Colorado Springs at age 74. Captain Franklin Williams arrived an hour early to every shift as a Detroit firefighter, a position he held for more than 30 years. Dedicated and talented, Frank excelled in everything he did, his daughter said. He was a gifted tradesman, cook, and dancer. The former high school athlete went on to coach football with the Police Athletic League for 13 years. In his later years, when he wasn't on the golf course, the 58-year-old spent time with his wife, seven children, and four grandchildren. There are times the story behind a painting matches the beauty of the work itself. As special correspondent Jared Bowen reports on a hidden history behind the ceiling of the Rotunda in Boston's Museum of Fine Arts.
The upper reaches of the Museum of Fine Arts Rotunda is where the gods and goddesses live. They stand in radiant glory, they ride chariots, and they soar on feathered wings. They are white and idealized. But they are him.
The man in these drawings was clearly black, and I thought, what's going on here? Who is this man? Has anyone figured out who he is?
These murals and figures have hovered over the MFA for roughly a century, since they were conceived by painter John Singer Sargent in 1916. But it's only now that there's been a comprehensive look at Thomas McKellar, the black model behind the murals. It's all thanks to an accidental discovery at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum by collection curator Nathaniel Silver.
I opened the wrong cabinet and happened to find this portfolio. It was huge, and I had never seen the Sargent drawings before.
That find has led to Boston's Apollo, an exhibition examining the relationship between Sargent and McKellar, who was the painter's principal model for the MFA murals, an artistic relationship lasting 8 years.
It wasn't that just anyone could have helped Sargent get to this point. It was Thomas McKellar specifically that allowed Sargent to unlock a creative potential that had not been tapped before.
Sargent was a celebrity painter and tired of doing the portraiture that was his bread and butter when he received the MFA commission. In these charcoal sketches Sargent ultimately gave to his friend and patron Isabella Stewart Gardner, we find the artist drawing the fine contours of McKellar, a sometime contortionist turned stand-in for mythological gods.
He was a veteran, a Roxbury resident. He came from Wilmington, North Carolina in the 1890s in the wake of devastating racial violence.
There is little known about the extent of the relationship between the two men. But consider this Sargent painting of McKellar. It's Sargent's only major nude and was hung prominently in his studio, never intended for public view.
Sargent lavished attention in making this work. You can see it in the highlights on the shoulders and on the chest here, this incredible tiny little shadow just over the Adam's apple and another one just under the bottom lip. This was not a painting that was dashed off in a few strokes. This was a painting that he spent an incredible amount of time, effort, and love in making.
The first thing I saw was all the drawings together.
Performance artist Helga Davis is a visiting curator who directed this short film in which the last of McKellar's direct descendants literally comes face to face with his legacy.
These sketches of my great uncle are really a means of survival for him.
What do you see when you look up at those murals?
I see you made Apollo, you made these things, and here's the body that inspired it.
How could we possibly forget somebody who played so pivotal a role in the production of Boston's public art? That's a question that revolves around blind spots in the discipline of art history, of history, and of society in general.
The Gardner is confronting history here, calling out the erasure of a black man by a white artist a century ago, and what that looks like today, when there is finally a reclamation. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jared Bowen in Boston, Massachusetts.
So fascinating. Thank you, Jared. And on the NewsHour online right now, to many fans, actor Chadwick Boseman's death was a shock and added to the grief that many are already feeling this year. We explore what he and his film roles meant, especially to young people. That is on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. We hope you have a safe weekend. Thank you all, and good night.